You know, if you look on your front porch right now, there is probably a plain brown cardboard box just sitting there.
Oh, almost certainly.
Or maybe, you know, there's a huge stack of them broken down in your recycling bin from last week. And we tend to look at shipping boxes as just a container.
Right, just a means to an end.
Exactly, like a temporary vessel, something completely mundane that you just tear open and throw away.
Yeah, nobody really gives them a second thought.
Right. But I mean, what if I told you that this completely boring everyday object is actually the hidden engine dictating business efficiency, profitability, and customer satisfaction?
It sounds a bit dramatic when you put it like that, but it is entirely true.
It is. Today, we are cracking open a massive stack of research on box optimization to see exactly where profit margins go to die. So, okay, let's unpack this literally and figuratively.
I love that. Let's do it.
Because whether you are, you know, shipping vintage clothes from a side hustle out of your garage, or maybe managing a massive fulfillment warehouse, or just trying to understand why a tiny bottle of vitamins arrived in a box the size of a microwave.
We've all been there.
Right. It's wild.
Right.
But this deep dive is going to completely change how you look at the packages arriving on your doorstep.
It really does shift your perspective when you dig into this stuff, because you realize that most packaging problems, like the damaged goods, the outrageous shipping fees, the chaotic warehouse floors, they aren't caused by a lack of options.
Which is what you would assume, right? That you just need more box sizes.
Exactly. You'd think, oh, we don't have the right box.
Yeah.
But the overarching culprit across all the data we looked at is actually inconsistency.
Inconsistency. So, meaning a business has too many choices available, but no real underlying logic for how to actually use them.
That is the core of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Just picture a
Yeah.
really busy warehouse floor for a second. A packing employee has an order in front of them, and behind them is this massive wall of, say, 20 different box sizes.
Just a wall of cardboard.
Right. And without strict, clear rules, that employee is forced to make a reactive decision on the fly every single time. They literally have to do mental geometry for every single order.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't thought about the mental toll of that.
It's huge. And when you multiply those few seconds of hesitation or just the cognitive load of solving a spatial puzzle,
Right, trying to figure out if this mug fits with this t-shirt in this specific box.
exactly. You multiply that across hundreds or maybe thousands of shipments a day, and a business accumulates massive operational debt.
So, I mean, the obvious solution then would be to just take away that wall of 20 boxes, which sounds counterintuitive, but limiting options becomes a superpower here, right?
What's fascinating here is that fewer decisions actually speed up fulfillment exponentially. The sweet spot seems to be adopting a very small set of core standard box sizes.
Like, how small are we talking?
3 to 5.
Tops. 3 to 5 sizes total.
Yeah. 3 to 5 sizes will cover the vast majority of products for almost any operation.
It's like having a capsule wardrobe instead of a messy, overflowing closet.
That is a perfect analogy.
You know, you don't have to stand there in the morning trying to figure out what matches. You just grab what works because it's a curated system.
Right.
So, say you run an apparel company. You have a small box for phone cases, a medium box for shoes, a large one for jackets, and I don't know, maybe an extra large for multi-item orders. Period. That's it.
That's all you need. And beyond the mental relief for the packer, that capsule wardrobe approach completely transforms the physical reality of the workspace itself.
Because you don't have 20 piles of boxes everywhere.
Exactly. Cardboard is inherently bulky.
Yeah.
Having 20 sizes means 20 different stacks of inventory. It eats up valuable square footage. It creates tripping hazards, and it just physically slows down the movement of the workers.
Well, and I noticed a really specific detail in the research about that physical space, too.
Yeah.
You should keep those core boxes flat until the exact moment they are needed.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I think people assume, you know, pre-assembling boxes during downtime gets them ahead of the rush, like they're being proactive.
Right. They think they are saving time for later.
But all they're really doing is filling their warehouse with literal empty air.
Yeah.
You're just storing empty volume, unless your storage facility is like massive and your daily volume is so predictable that you know for a fact you'll use all those pre-built boxes by 5 p.m. Just keep them flat.
Building boxes in advance is a classic example of confusing activity with productivity.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
It feels like work, you
Yeah.
know? You're moving, you're taping things,
Yeah.
but it's actually creating a massive storage bottleneck.
But wait, I have to push back on this rigid 3 to 5 sizes rule for a second. Okay,
Let's hear it.
doesn't having fewer box options pretty much guarantee that a lot of items just won't fit perfectly. I mean, if I am stripping away all those intermediate sizes, I am absolutely going to end up with some really awkward fits, right?
You are. And that is a deliberate strategic trade-off. The slight compromise in having a mathematically perfect fit for every single unique item is completely outweighed by the sheer speed of fulfillment.
So you just sacrifice the perfect fit for the sake of speed.
Exactly. When packers don't have to stop and compare options, they enter a flow state. Decision fatigue just vanishes. They just execute.
You're trading a geometric perfection for operational speed. I get that. But let's follow that logic for a second.
Sure.
If an item doesn't quite fit into the small core box, the immediate instinctual human reaction is going to be to reach for the medium box.
Right.
You just default to something oversized just to get it packed and out the door. And honestly, based on the research, that seems like a massive trap.
Oh, is the single most expensive mistake a business can make in fulfillment.
Really? The single most expensive?
Yes. Defaulting to an oversized box triggers a financial penalty that most people just do not fully understand. It all comes down to how shipping carriers actually calculate their fees.
Right, because shipping costs are not just about throwing a box on a scale to see how heavy it is anymore.
Not at all.
There's this concept called dimensional weight pricing, or DIM weight.
Let's break down the mechanics of DIM weight, because this is where the hidden debt really starts to pile up.
Yeah, please do.
So carriers like FedEx, UPS, the Postal Service, they only have so much physical space in their delivery trucks and their cargo planes.
Space is finite.
Exactly. If a business ships a 1-pound pillow in a massive box, that box takes up the space of 50 densely packed, heavier items.
Which means the carrier is losing out on the money they could have made shipping those 50 items.
Precisely. So to protect their own margins, carriers started charging based on volume, not just gravity.
So how do they actually calculate that penalty?
It's pretty straightforward math. They take the length, width, and height of your box, multiply them together to get the cubic volume, and then they divide that number by a specific dimensional factor.
Okay, what kind of factor?
Let's say 139, which is a fairly common divisor in the industry. The resulting number from that equation is your dimensional weight. So if your actual item weighs, say, 2 pounds, but the math says the box's dimensional weight is 15 pounds, the carrier charges you for a 15-pound shipment.
Oh, wow. So you are quite literally paying top dollar to ship empty air.
You are. And the margin of error is brutal here.
How so?
Even a tiny increase in the length, width, or height of a box, sometimes just an inch or two, can push that calculation over a threshold and into a completely different, much higher pricing tier.
But the financial hit doesn't even stop at the carrier fees, does it? Because now you have this oversized box with a small item inside it. You have to fill that void?
Yes, exactly.
So you are paying extra for the larger box itself. You are paying the higher shipping tier because of the DIM weight. And you are paying for, I don't know, feet of bubble wrap or craft paper just to take up the space you literally just paid to ship.
It's absurd when you lay it all out like that. And it brings up a really dangerous misconception in packaging logistics. When faced with an oversized box, the natural assumption is that, well, stuffing it to the brim with packing peanuts or those plastic air pillows will just solve the problem.
Right. Make it secure.
But it doesn't. Adding more filler into a too large box just masks the underlying error. It doesn't fix it.
I mean, shipping a small item in a giant box with some peanuts is like putting a single tennis ball in a clothes dryer. It's just going to get absolutely battered.
That is a perfect visualization of the physics involved. We have to remember, the logistics network is violent.
Violent. That's a strong word for it.
But it's true. Boxes are dropped from heights onto conveyor belts.
Huh.
They're stacked in these intensely vibrating trucks, and they get tossed into delivery vans. The number one cause of shipping damage isn't external crushing.
Oh, really? It's not things being stacked on top.
No, it's internal movement. When an item has room to shift, the kinetic energy of transit causes it to bounce repeatedly against the inside walls of its own box.
And it doesn't matter how many peanuts you put in there, right? Because peanuts settle, air pillows deflate or pop. If there is empty space, that tennis ball is going to find a way to bounce around.
Preventing that internal movement through proper sizing is really the only reliable way to ensure a safe delivery. If a business relies on filler instead of a properly sized box, they are virtually guaranteeing a higher rate of damaged goods and costly customer returns.
Okay, so let's look at the puzzle we've built here.
Okay.
We are strictly limiting our inventory to just 3 to 5 core sizes to maintain our packing speed. But we also absolutely have to avoid using oversized boxes so we don't get destroyed by dimensional weight pricing and internal shipping damage.
Right. Those are the constraints.
So what happens when a really awkwardly shaped item comes along, like something super long and skinny, like a poster tube or something shaped like a triangle?
Well, this is where the packer actually has to shift from being just a passive assembler to actively modifying the materials. We're talking about smart resizing and somewhat controversial technique called Frankensteining.
Frankensteining. I love that term so much. Let's start with smart resizing. The premise here is that instead of buying a whole new box size for a weird item, you just trim down one of your core boxes to eliminate the empty space.
Right. But the execution of that is everything.
Right. You can't just hack at it.
Exactly. You can't just take a box cutter and haphazardly slice off the top flaps. That totally destroys the structural integrity of the box.
So how do you do it?
The proper method involves using a specialized tool called a box resizer.
Oh, I've seen these. It's like a little hand tool with a small metal scoring wheel on it, right?
Yes, exactly. You run that wheel along the inside wall of the cardboard at the exact height you need. And crucially, the tool doesn't cut through the cardboard.
It just scores it.
It scores it. It crushes the inner fluting just enough to create a clean, natural hinge. And that allows you to fold the sides down sharply and cleanly.
Okay, I see.
So you essentially manufacture a custom, snug-fitting box out of a larger one in about 10 seconds, and you do it without compromising the strength of the walls at all.
That's brilliant. And then there's Frankensteining.
Yes, Frankenstein.
This is for the true outliers, right? An item so unusual that no single standard box is going to work. And you definitely do not want to pay some massive premium to have a custom box manufactured just for one weird order.
Exactly.
So you splice two or more boxes together to create a custom sleeve.
It is highly practical in a pinch, but introduces a major structural vulnerability.
The seams.
The seams. When you join two boxes together, the seams where the cardboard overlaps become immediate weak points. You are physically interrupting the continuous strength of the material.
Because now you have two separate pieces of cardboard pulling in completely different directions every time the box is jostled.
And those connection points end up taking all the sheer stress when that Frankenstein box is stacked under heavier packages in the back of a delivery truck.
Right.
If you just slap a single piece of regular packing tape over that seam, the tension will almost certainly cause it to split open during transit.
So what do you do?
Those joints must be heavily reinforced. We are talking multiple layers of high tensile tape, or even better, plastic strapping. A Frankenstein box is really only as strong as its weakest seam.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here regarding the reality of an actual warehouse floor.
Go for it.
If I'm a busy worker and the mail truck is arriving in 20 minutes and I still have 50 orders left on my desk, is stopping to play arts and crafts with a little scoring wheel or carefully taping together a Frankenstein sleeve actually worth my time?
It's a fair question.
It just feels like those seconds would be much better spent just grabbing an oversized box, throwing in some peanuts, and moving on to the next order.
It is the single most common pushback you hear from fulfillment teams. And I get it, it sounds like a terrible trade-off at first, but let's look at the math.
Okay, hit me with the math.
Spending, say, 15 extra seconds to score and fold down a box might reduce its dimensional weight by 5 pounds. Depending on the shipping zone you're sending it to, that could easily save the business $4 or $5 on just a single shipment.
Wow, okay, that is significant.
Right, if a worker saves $5 in 15 seconds, that equates to a cost-saving rate of over $1,000 an hour.
That is insane.
The upfront time investment pays off exponentially.
Not to mention, you know, you completely prevent the need for extra filler material, and you lock the item in place so it doesn't bounce around and trigger a damaged return.
Exactly.
It really is about prioritizing stability over aesthetics. Like, a customer might receive a heavily taped, weirdly shaped Frankenstein box.
And it might look a little ugly.
Very ugly. But if the item inside is completely secure and fully intact when they open it, they are going to be infinitely happier than if they received this beautiful, pristine, oversized box that just contains a shattered product.
Form must follow function and logistics. The courier does not care how pretty your box is. They only care that it is rigid and stable on their conveyor belts.
But, you know, even if you cut down a box perfectly so there is zero empty space, you are still walking into a trap if the physical material you just manipulated can't actually handle the load.
That's a great point.
Which brings us to the physical integrity of the cardboard itself. Because not all cardboard is created equal.
Far from it. And this is where a lot of businesses experience a major disconnect. between their procurement team, the people sitting in an office buying the supplies, and the actual warehouse floor.
Let me guess, procurement just looks at the price tag.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Procurement sees two boxes of the exact same size on a website, but one is 10 cents cheaper, so they buy it in bulk to save money.
Right.
What they don't realize is they just bought single-walled corrugated cardboard for a product that desperately requires double-walled strength.
Let's define that really quick. The strength of a box comes from that wavy paper inside the walls, right? The fluting.
Yes. The fluting provides the rigidity and the top-to-bottom stacking strength. Lightweight items, like, say, a plastic toy or a t-shirt, those can ship perfectly fine in thinner, standard, single-walled cardboard.
Okay.
But heavy items, like automotive parts or dense electronics, they exert tremendous outward pressure on the side walls of the box.
Because if you put a heavy car part into a thin box and the delivery truck takes a sharp turn, the sheer weight of the part shifts hard against the cardboard.
Exactly. The box flexes. And when a box flexes under a heavy load, it distorts the shape and usually splits right at the taped seams.
So box strength needs to explicitly match the item's weight. But the reverse of that is also a common error, right? Overbuilding.
Oh, yes. Shipping a t-shirt in a box meant for a bowling ball.
Right. Just massive overkill.
It happens all the time. Using heavy-duty, expensive, double-walled boxes for featherweight items needlessly inflates your material costs. The goal is always equilibrium.
Right.
You don't want to underbuild and suffer catastrophic blowouts, but you don't want to overbuild and just burn through your packaging budget for no reason.
Well, and this logic completely applies to reusing boxes, too. Reusing boxes is a fantastic way to cut costs, and obviously it's environmentally friendly.
Absolutely.
But there are strict limits. You can safely reuse a box, but never if it has soft corners, weakened walls, or crushed edges.
The structural integrity of a box is severely compromised the very moment the fluting is crushed. A dented corner means the box has already lost a significant percentage of its top-to-bottom compression strength.
So if the integrity is compromised, just recycle it. Don't risk a $50 product to save 50 cents on a reused box.
It's just bad math.
Because if you start mixing strong, brand new boxes with weak, compromised boxes in your workflow, your results become entirely unpredictable.
You completely lose all control over your quality standard. You might as well be rolling dice on whether an order actually arrives intact.
Now, speaking of cutting costs on boxes, here's where it gets really interesting. There is a brilliant strategy mentioned in the research for sourcing those weird, uncommon sizes we talked about earlier.
Yes, the community sourcing strategy.
Right. The sizes you only need occasionally, so you really don't want to buy them brand new from a supplier at a massive markup.
It is a phenomenal workaround that leverages asymmetric waste.
Meaning one company's trash is another company's cheap packaging. So using local community marketplaces, buy and sell groups, or commercial surplus listings. So many businesses, like think of furniture stores, appliance retailers, tech offices, they receive bulk shipments in massive, heavy-duty boxes that they literally immediately break down and then pay a service to throw away.
They are desperate to get rid of them.
Right.
You can often find unused or very lightly used specialty boxes in your local community for literal pennies on the dollar.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it keeps your overhead incredibly low for those really awkward shipments that simply will not fit into your core capsule wardrobe of standard sizes. And honestly, it's just smart business.
Well, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, customers actually notice this integrity immediately.
Oh, for perfect.
Receiving a damaged or poorly packed item instantly reduces trust in a brand. Whereas a well-fitted, structurally sound package, even if it's reused, reinforces professionalism and drastically reduces return rates.
Okay, so we've laid out this really robust manual system here.
We have.
Stick to 3 to 5 core sizes. Use a scoring tool to fold down for odd shapes. Heavily reinforce your Frankenstein seams. Match the cardboard fluting strength to the actual product weight. And hit up local marketplaces for cheap, odd sizes.
It's a solid playbook.
For a small to medium business, this is an airtight operation. But, as they say, success brings volume.
It does.
So what happens when a business goes from shipping 50 orders a day out of a garage to suddenly shipping 5,000 orders a day out of a commercial facility?
The entire paradigm shifts. This is the inflection point where all those brilliant manual rules we just talked about suddenly become the actual problem.
Because you just don't have the time.
Right. At 5,000 orders a day, having a human being stand there evaluating corner softness or manually scoring boxes with a little wheel it becomes a catastrophic bottleneck.
Right, you can't have your team playing leisurely spatial puzzle games when the conveyor belt is moving at full speed. You cannot scale manual decision-making indefinitely.
You can't. The only viable solution for that level of scale is automation. You have to shift the burden of decision-making from human intuition directly to intelligent software.
Which brings us to the tech side of things.
Exactly. The landscape completely changes with tools like ClickShip smart packaging solutions.
And this sounds like a massive leap forward. But how does software actually pack a box? I mean, I know it doesn't have robot arms physically folding the cardboard on the floor.
No. It handles the intellectual heavy lifting. It solves what computer scientists refer to as the 3D bin packing problem.
The 3D bin packing problem.
Yeah. Human beings are notoriously bad at three-dimensional spatial reasoning, especially when they're under the pressure of a ticking clock.
Oh, totally.
You look at three different items on a table, look at an empty box, and we just guess.
We just eyeball it and hope for the best.
Right. But an algorithm doesn't guess. When an order drops into the system, the software instantly analyzes the precise weight and the exact physical dimensions, so the length, width, and height of every single item in that specific cart.
Okay, so it knows exactly what needs to be packed.
Yes. And then, in a fraction of a second, the algorithm simulates virtually rotating and packing those items in every possible permutation.
Wow.
It compares them against the known dimensions of your 3 to 5 core boxes, and it mathematically calculates the absolute most efficient spatial arrangement.
So what does this all mean for the worker? It basically just tells the packer on a screen, take these 3 items and put them in box C.
Precisely. It completely eliminates the guesswork on the warehouse floor. The packer doesn't have to think about geometry. They just follow the directive on the screen.
That is amazing.
The software ensures that the smallest possible box is always chosen, which minimizes the empty space, completely avoids the dimensional weight penalties we discussed, and locks the items in tightly to prevent transit damage.
It takes the complex geometry totally out of the human's hands. Because, let's face it, technology doesn't get tired.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't suffer from decision fatigue at 4 p.m. on a Friday and just randomly grab an oversized box because it's easier and they want to go home.
Exactly. Technology doesn't replace the physical cardboard box, obviously, but it perfectly complements the standard rules. It ruthlessly enforces your rules at scale. It acts as a digital safeguard, stepping in precisely when human error and fatigue would otherwise start eating into your profit margins.
It just makes your operational efficiency totally predictable, regardless of how high your daily volume suddenly spikes. I mean, it is truly fascinating how much science, math, and structural engineering goes into something we usually just tear open with our car keys and throw into the recycling bin.
It is a deceptively complex ecosystem, for sure. But despite all the algorithms, all the dimensional weight calculations, and the structural physics we've discussed today, the entire strategy can actually be distilled down into one single golden rule from the research.
Oh, I love a golden rule. Let's hear it.
The rule is simply this. Use the smallest strong box that keeps the item completely still.
Use the smallest strong box that keeps the item completely still.
That's it.
It's incredibly elegant, honestly, because if it's the smallest box, you dodge the carrier's dimensional weight penalties and you save money on void fill.
Right.
If it's strong, you match the physical forces of transit and prevent blowouts. And if it keeps the item completely still, you eliminate that internal kinetic movement that causes the majority of shipping damage.
It balances cost, protection, and efficiency perfectly. It is the holy grail of fulfillment.
We have covered a tremendous amount of ground today. From standardizing an unwieldy inventory down to that capsule wardrobe of just a few core sizes, to understanding the massive financial trap of dimensional weight.
And we can't forget Frankensteining.
Never forget Frankensteining. Utilizing clever scoring tools, maintaining structural integrity by not reusing crushed boxes, and finally recognizing when it's time to just let automation algorithms take the wheel.
It's a full journey.
It really is. Standardizing your packaging isn't just about saving cardboard. It's about building a leaner, vastly more resilient business.
I completely agree. And, you know, I think that brings up a much broader question about how businesses operate in general.
Where are you going with this?
Well, we've spent this entire time unpacking the hidden complexities, the mathematical traps, and the operational debt tied to something as simple as the shipping box.
Yeah.
So I just want to leave you with a thought. If a plain, boring cardboard box holds so much hidden operational debt and untapped potential, what other mundane everyday materials or processes in your workflow are silently draining your resources right now just waiting to be optimized.